incompatibility, contractual terms. I'm going to spend quite a bit of time on counterfeit parts because, unfortunately, the Chinese in particular have really infiltrated our electronic parts source with a lot of counterfeit parts, ripoffs. And that created such an uproar that the federal government took some very strong action, and they've actually listed some new DFAR clauses that are imposed as of last year. Talk about escape defects, suppliers that are not qualified, lack of visibility, and poor source selection. These are just a few of the areas that can cause problems, but I think you can understand how there are so many things that you don't normally have access to or visibility into that can really cause problems. So let me, this is just one slide that I ended up developing to explain this whole concept of privity of contract, and I'll use the government, prime contractor, and subcontractors, but you can also have prime contractor, first tier, and second tier sub. The doctrine of privity of contract means the parties that execute a contract are the only ones that really have control over what goes on. So typically in a contract, you have two parties, the buyer and the seller. So if the government issues a prime contract to a Lockheed or a Raytheon, the government has privity of contract. In other words, they have the right to enforce the terms and conditions of the contract between themselves and the prime contractor. Now you have a subcontractor on the same prime contract. Guess what? The government has no contractual relationship with the subcontractor. So what that means is if the government wants to get control over a subcontractor, the only recourse they really have is to squeeze the prime contractor, to force the prime contractor to motivate. And the government is actually very, very strong on this whole concept that they've said, if you're a procuring contracting officer, you can't meddle in a subcontractor's terms and conditions. Now, there are a couple of clauses that may be mandatory flowdowns, but the government expects the prime to actually be the one to enforce the sub. So if we just kind of translate that, if you're the prime contractor over here, and this is the first tier sub, then a second tier sub is over here. So the only way that the prime contractor can have any influence on the second tier sub is to squeeze the first tier sub and to exert influence. And that's a critical point that I want to make. So let's talk about what you don't want to do. You don't want to get caught in this vice. If you're the prime and you're the sub, you don't want to get caught with incompatible contractual terms and conditions. So some of the areas of vulnerability, specs, contractual terms, payment terms, funding, warranties. That's a really good example. For example, a lot of companies may use standard terms and conditions, and they may say, okay, for all of our procurements, we're going to have a 18-month or 24-month warranty. Well, what if your customer imposes special terms that say require a 24-month warranty and you float down an 18-month warranty? If the product fails at your sub, you may be on the hook to fix it, but if you haven't flowed that down to your sub, it's going to come out of your pocket. So those are some of the areas that you really have to be careful about. Things like data rights, right? Rights to data. The government may flow down a requirement to you that if they've paid for the development of a product, they own the intellectual property. You better flow that down to your subs, and your subs better flow it down to their subs. Otherwise, the government's going to come after you and say, I want all of the IP associated with the software or this hardware, and they could come after you. If you haven't flowed it down to your supply chain, guess what? You're going to have to negotiate with the supply chain. You don't get paid by your customer, but you're going to be caught in the middle, and that's really difficult. So those are just a couple of examples of things that can get you into trouble, and you really need to be careful about that kind of thing. So let's talk a little bit about sub-tier or lower-tier supplier management. This is just one example, but in this case, you can easily see that there could be six tiers in the supply chain, from raw materials to the next higher assembly to higher levels of assembly, integrators and subsystems, and then you have tier one. So the problem with this is that anything in the supply chain could cause a problem. There is a famous, what we call a Swiss cheese chart. And if you talk about an escape, you could have a problem anywhere in the supply chain, and it could propagate all the way to the end result. I mean, if you think about the Challenger disaster, and I actually had the unfortunate experience to be there when it blew up. That was a TRW satellite that was on that Challenger mission. And we're talking about the O-rings, which would have been probably down in the fourth or fifth tier that could not withstand the cold temperature that was in effect during that day in January. I think it was 1986. But you could have a problem here that ends up causing a major system failure. So the areas that could cause problems, inadequate requirements flow down, or you could have in any one of the tiers a out-of-control process, or you could have a supplier that's really not qualified to do the work, or people could make bad assumptions about requirements allocation, margin, just a whole host of things. But the key takeaway here is that a problem anywhere in the supply chain could result in a major system failure. So that's why the supply chain is so important for overall reliability. So now let's talk about how do you balance, if you're, say, a prime contractor, how do you balance the control of your supply chain? And so we've got this seesaw. On the left side, you have this doctrine of privity of contract, which means you can only control the company that you wrote the contract with. On the other hand, you need to have the full visibility as to what's going on in that supply chain. And so things like rights to audit, how do you validate processes, you know, talk about AS 9100, for example, and how do we ensure that our lower tier suppliers are managing their supply chain. So there are a couple of techniques. These are just some recommendations. I'm sure there are others. But I think what you want to do is you want to first make sure that you flow down all of the important requirements, whether there are quality requirements or standards like CMMI or AS9100. Make sure that key requirements are flowed down. The other thing you want to do is you want to make sure that you do an appropriate risk assessment to identify those areas of risk and make sure that the suppliers that are in charge of that area do an appropriate risk identification, risk mitigation process. The next thing is when you do source selection, you want to make certain that your suppliers are being evaluated for their thoroughness and their processes in managing their supply chains. You want to make sure that they've got a good filter to weed out those suppliers that don't have the capability to perform. You also want to make sure that they, in fact, are being proactive about managing risk and that they have a good process for flowing down things. So, you know, I've done a lot of AS9100 training. And there are actually paragraphs in AS9100, for those of you who are familiar with the standard. It's the 7.41 to 7.43, and it's called control of purchasing. But that is a pretty good standard. If you comply with those three paragraphs, you've got a pretty good idea that there's a well-defined process for managing the supply chain. It's amazing, though, if you do an audit on companies and you ask for objective evidence as to whether or not they're doing the things that are called out in the standards, how many of them are not doing that? So I think that's a good way of checking the capability of your supply chain. The third thing that you want to do is you definitely need to be proactive, and I'm a big believer in active quality mission assurance management, maybe because I worked in that field for a while, but I think it's also really important. First thing program managers like to do is they like to cut the mission assurance or quality budget, and that's probably the worst thing in the world to do, because you really need to have some people who have their antenna up and they're attuned to looking for these things. And you want to be process-based. And so I really like to drive home the fact that what you do have control over from this whole concept of privity of contract, you have control over the suppliers that report directly to you, the ones that you have a contract with. So the things that I've listed here are the things that you want to ask your suppliers, you want to validate that they're, in fact, following those processes. That's really key. And if they're not, a red flag should go up, and you really need to make sure that you're protecting yourself, because that's where the risk falls in. So, how do you know that the system is working or not working? Well, again, I like to think that you need to sample what's going on in your first-tier suppliers to make sure that they're doing the due diligence when they're assessing and selecting their suppliers, that they've got a good process for flowing down requirements, that they're doing pre-award surveys, and they're doing audits on a regular basis. I mean, there are a lot of companies, including some of the ones that I work for, that would grandfather grandfather suppliers, and you'd say, well, when was the last time you actually went to the company and did a comprehensive audit? Oh, we don't have any budget for that, but, you know, they're doing okay. But that's really important to make sure that people are watching that, they're looking at the data, they're looking at Pareto analysis for failures, they're ensuring that corrective and preventive actions are implemented. And then I think you want to make sure that there are good procedures for managing the suppliers, review quality records, check the frequency for audits, and I think also to make sure that they're periodically and continuously evaluating their suppliers. So that's a good segue into this chart. I spent quite a bit of time my last tour of duty at Northrop developing a supplier rating system that's used throughout the corporation. And I think some of the key things that are really important when you're trying to manage a supply chain and also to look out for potential problems, you need to do ratings on a frequent, periodic basis. I'd really recommend quarterly. I think that's probably the right amount of time. Monthly is a little bit too demanding. I think if you do it annually, too many things can escape your span of control. I think you need to be objective in the way that you rate suppliers, because one of the things that you do want to do, kind of jump to the bottom here, is a 360 feedback loop with your suppliers to give them feedback on the objective evidence that you collect as to how well or not well they're performing, and identify opportunities for improvement. I think whatever you do, you need to have a consistent set of standards so that if you're rating different companies, different suppliers, you're applying the same yardstick as to which suppliers are good and which ones have some areas of shortfall. One of the things I think is really important also, again, to relate to the prior topic of lower tier suppliers, is you want to evaluate or rate your first tier suppliers on how they're managing their supply chain. And also, whatever you do, it needs to be compatible with different types of work. I mean, some companies do hardware, some do services, some do software, and a lot of the typical supplier rating systems just kind of do a kick and count type of thing. And you need to be able to evaluate software development, hardware design and development, O&M support, et cetera. And also, you want to have some adult supervision to make sure that there's management that's reviewing these things so that there is, again, a consistent approach so that if somebody has a vendetta against a particular supplier, there can be an equalizing factor. But if, again, if a supplier is really not performing well and you can look at it across the enterprise, you can drive home a message. So the last thing on this is the data needs to be supportive so that you can do Pareto or trend analysis. I'll just show two screenshots from a supply rating system that I've been working on. Unfortunately, the resolution here isn't as good as I'd like. I think we needed a few more pixels, but a lot of these systems, and again, we're kind of missing our color, but if you use a four-color system, red means you're in deep trouble. This should be a yellow, which means it's marginal. Green means everything is fine, and blue, you're kind of walking on water. Now, interestingly enough, the Air Force has a system called the CPAR, that's Contractor Performance Assessment Report, and they use a five-color system. So in addition to the red, yellow, green, and blue, they have a purple, which means very good. I don't think you need to have five colors, but the concept is essentially the same. And what you can have is different things under management. You can include program management, management responsiveness, staffing, and then you could have a bunch of technical things. And again, you can pick and choose. You could have software development. You could have system engineering, KPIs, key performance indicators. A few more on here. You can have schedule. You could actually pump in earned value if you are on an earned value management system. So you can put in schedule performance and cost performance indices, quality and mission assurance, process effectiveness. I highlighted this. You can use this to judge how your supplier manages their supply chain, which, again, emphasizes this whole concept of lower tier supplier management, customer satisfaction. This is just sort of nominal. It's very similar to the Air Force's CPAR type of system, but it provides you a platform at least to have a objective dialogue on how your supply chain is performing. Okay, the final area that I want to talk about is counterfeit parts. How many of you have heard that there is a big issue in this country with counterfeit parts? It is enormous. And there's a picture here, and it's actually not that untrue. Guess what happens to those old PCs and laptops you got rid of? They end up in the third world, and they've got kids, people who earn pennies a day, who are reflowing the solder, removing devices from printed circuit boards. And then they go into factories where they actually blacktop or spray paint the integrated circuits and put on false markings, you know, put on Intel, Motorola, Microsemi, put in fictitious lot date codes. They'll even give you certificates of conformance, by the way, whatever you need. There's only one problem. These are not real parts, or they're reused and they've been damaged. And it's a big issue. And what happened a couple of years ago is the Senate had a special committee chaired by John McCain and Carl Levin. And they actually called a bunch of CEOs, including the CEO of Health Recom. My CEO at the time, Wes Bush from Northrop, was called to that. And I think they brought in the CEO of Raytheon also. I'm not 100% sure on that. But they had a real grilling. And one of the questions they asked was, what are you guys doing? How can you guarantee that the warfighter is not getting navigation systems and guidance control systems that have been populated by people like that? And here's another cartoon of what happens with those scrapped electronic sub-assemblies, and it's really pretty scary. So what happened is the GAO got involved after the Senate Armed Services Committee had their hearings, and you can see here in the quotations, counterfeit parts, blah, 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 seriously disrupt the Department of Defense supply chain, harm weapons systems integrity, and endanger troops' lives. So, you know, one of the things that happens when you have a committee like this chaired by a bunch of powerful senators is the government decides to take action. So they used a multi-prong approach. The first thing they did is they modified the Defense Authorization Act of 2012, and they added a new section called 818. And some of the things that they included in 818, first thing they said is, if you're a contractor and you supply electronic parts that are or could be defective, it's on your nickel. You're responsible for any rework and corrective action, and the cost to do that is unallowable. Even if you're on a cost reimbursable contract, the costs for that are unallowable. So you start thinking about, you could have a third tier supplier that has a counterfeit integrated circuit, and you're the prime contractor, government's going to come after you, and that thing may require thousands of man hours to remove and replace and retest. All of those costs are unallowable. It's coming right out of profit. And then they had another one, that third bullet, any contractor or subcontractor who becomes aware or has reason to suspect that any end item component by a contractor has to notify the government data exchange program, it's called GIDEP, within 60 days. So there's a time limit on that. But not to leave things just with a Appropriations Act, it took 2 years, it was supposed to be, I think, 9 months from the date of that Appropriations Act. It took 2 years, but there was a final a release of a number of new DFAR clauses. And I won't go into all the details, but they have definition of what a counterfeit part is, what a contractor's counterfeit part detection and prevention system must be. But the bottom line here is, if you're a contractor or a subcontractor of a prime contractor who has this DFAR clause invoked, if you don't have a system in place, you can have your purchasing system disapproved. There's a thing called the CPSR, for those of you who are familiar, it's called the Contractors Purchasing System Review. If that is reviewed and you're a contractor on a government contract, you can't place one PO without asking the government, mother may I. It is a big deal. It's a very big deal. Yes?
But there's no reference now to counterfeit bolts and that sort of thing?
It's a good question. There is another standard. I'm going to talk about the electronic parts, which is really the biggest one. And just hold it for a second. I'll talk about it. But that's next. You're a good straight man. So here's a summary of a couple of the new DFARs. So here's the definition. Counterfeit electronic part means unlawful or unauthorized reproduction, substitution, or alteration, knowingly mismarked, misidentified, unmodified part from the original manufacturer, or a source. So what it's saying is, hey, if it isn't produced by the original manufacturer or a company that's licensed from the original manufacturer, it's a counterfeit. And then contractors have to maintain an acceptable counterfeit electronic part detection and avoidance system. Failure to maintain this may result in disapproval of the purchasing system and or withholding of payments. So they're really putting their mouth where their money is. And then this is what's called out on the counterfeit electronic part detection avoidance system, training, inspection, process to abolish counterfeit part, process for maintaining electronic part. This is a big one here. Use of suppliers that are the original manufacturer, that's also known as the OCM or OEM, or sources with the express written authorization of the original manufacturer. So that would be, say, a licensee, someone who has the IP in writing from the original manufacturer to produce the parts. That's who you have to go to now to buy the parts. So in a lot of programs, you know, all the defense contractors would not only go from the original guys, but they would also go from distributors. But the problem has been with what's called an independent distributor, a distributor that is not licensed by the manufacturer. So think of it as eBay. You go buy, I just made the example of buying some bad Microsoft Office on eBay, and it turned out to be counterfeit. I didn't know about it till I called Microsoft when I couldn't get it authenticated. There's been a lot of that stuff in our industry where people would go and they'd have problems with lead time, or they'd try to find the lowest price bidder, and they go to these independent distributors. Guess what? A lot of the independent distributors buy it from that lady who's been standing over a hot plate, reflowing solder, removing parts. So the problem is, not only do you have to go to the sources that are authorized, but you have to also have a process for reporting any incident that is known as a suspect counterfeit, if you suspect there's counterfeit parts, and you have to have a process for quarantining those and ultimately turning them over to the government. So it's a very big deal. Let's see. You have to flow down these counterfeit requirements, so the FAR clauses are mandatory flow downs. You have to review through this GuideUp website all the postings. Typically, the government data exchange program shows anywhere from like 5 to 10 suspect counterfeit reports per month. You have to have a process in place for reviewing those. And the biggest issue here, the big challenge, is what if you have a mature program and the government wants to buy more, and the manufacturer is no longer making that part? It's known as parts obsolescence. So what do you do? Now, if the government wants to pay for redesign, then you can design out the part. But guess what? A lot of times there's the whole umbrella of affordability. The government doesn't have the budget for that. So now you're kind of stuck, because the DFAR clause says, whenever possible, you go to the original manufacturer. If the original manufacturer has closed up shop for that part, now you have to go to these third-party sources. So what you need then is you have to have a robust process for screening, and that includes visual inspection, electrical testing. Yes?
Regarding the counterfeit part, to what extent do you think that lowest cost
I think it's been a big factor. I'll tell you one other thing which I think is critical, and this is not my opinion, but I happened a couple of years ago to go to a symposium held by a U.S. District Attorney, U.S. Federal Prosecutor, was down in D.C., and this was a lady who ended up prosecuting a company in Florida called Vision Tech. And the owner ended up selling something like $40 million worth of counterfeit parts. And when he was caught, he committed suicide. His assistant, though, was sent to the slammer for about 5 years. And this U.S. attorney said that the biggest threat in her mind was the government's regulation to give so much business away to small businesses. She said, if I had my way, I would eliminate that requirement because that's what was driving things. So on one hand, it's lower costs, but the bigger one was, I can tell you how many companies would go to these small businesses to get their goals because, you know, the federal government also has certain goals for small business allocations. And this prosecutor, this is not my judgment, I'm just quoting what I was told, felt very strongly that that was responsible for some of the proliferation of counterfeit. I think it's a combination of factors. I think, though, this is a game changer in terms of now that there are new FAR requirements, it's really going to force contractors to go to the original sources wherever possible. And then when you have obsolete parts, you have to embark on a very rigorous testing program. You're welcome. So what this means, if you're in this ball game and you're selling products that contain electronic parts, if you want to keep your purchasing system approved, you have to have a counterfeit parts prevention program. And what it says is wherever possible, you go first to the original component manufacturers or their authorized distributors. And if you can't find the parts and your customer doesn't want to design them out, then you have to go through a rigorous inspection and testing program to make sure that you've screened out any potential suspect counterfeit parts. So that really is a game changer in this whole area. So, yeah, sure. Well, you know, it's kind of interesting when you, you talk to some people in the government and they said, well, you should have been doing this in the first place. You're telling me that when I was buying things from you before, you couldn't guarantee that counterfeit parts would be screened out. So that's a position I've heard from some government reps. However, on the other hand, from a practical standpoint, it's going to cost more. It's going to do two things. One, it's going to drive the cost up because you're limiting the number of places where you can go buy the parts. The other thing is lead times are going to increase because you've got more companies trying to go to the same guys to buy the parts. So it is a real issue, especially with the pressure because of sequestration and affordability to drive costs down. And this would appear at first glance to be in the opposite direction.
I'm also assuming that this type of administrative oversight and quality assurance, quality control, inspection, and research would be very hard for even a mid-sized company to be able to distribute.
Absolutely. No, I'm not arguing.
That would lead us to believe that only the big boys can really afford this type of prime responsibility.
But it's more than the prime. What I'm saying is this has to cascade down.
It goes all the way through, but the prime is ultimately responsible.
Right. So I don't care where you go. I mean, you talk to all the tier ones, the Lockheeds, the Northrops, the Boeings, the Raytheons. And we're all dealing with this, and they all have instituted counterfeit parts processes and preventive measures, and it's going to cause, and it has caused a ripple effect. Yeah, it's a big issue. And as a matter of fact, one of the reasons that DFAR, a series of DFAR clauses took almost 2 years to get out was that all of the primes had an opportunity to comment on those. And I was on one of the Northrop teams that reviewed and commented on that, but all of the primes provided input and those were some of the issues that they talked about: availability of parts, increase in price, lead time, impact on the socioeconomic programs, as they're officially known. So it is a big issue. There is one other thing. You guys are all familiar with SAE because they have AS9100. Well, they also have released a standard called AS5553, Revision A. And the government actually used that standard. A lot of the things that were called out in AS5553 found their way into the DFAR clause, including the priority of where you're going to go to buy things, like from the original or authorized distributors. It also contains a big section on what to do when you can't buy an original part and you have to go through a screening process. So this is a very thorough document. Now, to answer your question, there is another standard called AS6174, which deals with non-electronic parts. And so you can just kind of extrapolate where the government's going to go, and that is to impose a similar thing on mechanical structural parts like fasteners, nuts, bolts, et cetera. So there is a standard that's in work for non-electronic parts. And my prediction is, with the aircraft industry providing so much to DOD, you're going to see a similar thing in that area as well. But right now, the government was focusing on the electronic parts. Hit this lead time. Parts obsolescence is a very big issue. Impact on the small business goals, because there are a lot of good companies that happen to be small business. But you can see the issue then of the big tier ones saying, hey, wait a minute, we don't want to take the chance. Some tier ones have kind of worked through mentor-protege type of programs to bolster the processes for some of their preferred small business partners to help alleviate the impact of implementation with that. Flow down and implementation by sub-tier suppliers, COTS, commercial off the shelf. You can imagine trying to tell HP or Apple, hey, you're going to have to impose these requirements. So, you know, if you have a HP laptop, it's embedded in a deliverable system to Department of the Army, you know, do these requirements apply? And you can just see DOD trying to impose that on a commercial contractor. And you know what a commercial contractor would probably do. They tell them you buy it somewhere else. And clearly, impact on program cost, I think, is a big factor. So I just wanted to make sure all of you were aware of what's been going on in the industry. I think it's a pretty big shift in the way things are going. But the government is clearly sending a message that they don't want to get stuck with products that have counterfeit in them. And if they do get stuck, they expect the contractor on their own nickel to pick up the cost. So I've kind of walked through a couple of key topics, and I'll be glad to answer any questions any of you have. But these are just a couple of the risks in the supply chain. I think with the global supply chain that we're all using nowadays, you know, it's really important to be able to control processes that control procurement. I believe certain standards like AS9100 have some very good things in them, and that if you use standards as a guideline, it can help. And again, one of the things AS9100 says is organizations are responsible for the quality or conformity of the product, irrespective of where or how it's obtained. So you just can't say, hey, the government said I should go to this source. You've got to be, and that's where it ends. So with that, yeah, Greg.
Real quick question. In the era of 3D printing, what type of Pandora's box is being opened?
I agree. It could make things a lot more complicated, especially for mechanical parts. Yeah. Any other questions? Yes.
So, in commercial world, okay, I work for public company, and so there we typically go and buy from known sources, like, let's say, Intel's, Texas right. Instruments, and so forth. What is the risk of getting hit with counterfeit from those type of companies?
Very little. Very little. If you, the biggest risk, and one of the things I did in my last job at Northrop was I had developed the counterfeit parts system. I actually went into the GITHUB database and had a chance to look at the reports. And I would say 95% of the counterfeit came from these independent distributors. If you go directly to the guys that make the product, virtually no risk at all.
Now, occasionally, we run into the obsolescence issue as well. And lately, what we've been doing is our supply chain goes and says, hey, I found Tom, Dick, and Harry. They got this part that we need. And you know what? We can make this part go for, we can build more of these widgets for another year if we go and buy from them. And then I have these discussions with them, and I start asking these questions, and then it's kind of like, I can see like 10 different ways someone could be shady if they wanted to be. Kind of like to point that, well, if I'm an employee there, I could, let me open up this bag, take this one out, and yep. put something else in there, and show it off. So I don't know.
Well, there are a couple of things that you need to watch out for. One of them is chain of custody. And the part actually could be authentic, but it could have been removed from a product, solder reflowed, lids retinned, but that could have a deleterious effect on the reliability. So if somebody says, hey, I can get you these parts, you really need to have full traceability from the original component manufacturer. Every step of the way, you need good documentation. Now, it's true some fraudulent places can come up with fictitious chains of custody, but then there are things you can do in terms of visual inspection. You can look at things like retinning of leads, marks on the leads, and actually AS5553, that standard that I referenced, is a pretty good place to start, and I would recommend that you look at the guidelines in that in terms of what do you need to do to minimize the risk of getting a unauthentic part.
Our company's been working with this broker, and they follow those standards. But I always get the impression that they're kind of sloppy.
Well, you need to be pretty rigorous.
At their
yeah.
work,
Yeah.
Like I try to hammer, you guys got to, this is, we're buying $500,000 worth of product from you.
Well,
you need to treat it like that.
Well, what I would do is, again, I think there are going to be a lot of people, just like you have AS9100 lead auditors. You're going to have AS5553 lead auditors, and I think it probably would behoove someone to audit their processes against this new standard to make sure that they are, in fact, following the things called out in the standard. It's a pretty good reference point.
Now, the other thing you mentioned was traceability,
yeah.
which, that sounds like a great idea. So. The thing is, when you go to a broker, they'll never tell you where they bought it from.
And that's the risk.
Yeah.
Just like how I got burned on that counterfeit Office 10. And when I went back and complained, checked the seller at eBay, it had been removed. So, and then I looked at the comments, and these were not available when I bought the software 2 years ago. The comments were, this guy sells counterfeit software. So you really need to be careful. I think you had a question.
Yeah, more or less in and around the FCPA standards, the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, that kind of fits in here but wasn't really mentioned?
Yeah, it wasn't. I think, again, it could be, but you also have to realize that a lot of these distributors, for example, are very small. They've actually had distributors operating out of kitchen tables. You know, people going, no, I'm serious, with laptops. And there have been a couple of sting operations, and I think the FBI has gotten involved. I know they got involved with Vision Tech in Florida. And, you know, they've had people sitting at a kitchen table with laptops going on eBay and open markets buying things without any idea as to the source of the product. You know, just, I need so many devices, this part number, and they get them for a price. They have no idea what they are. So yeah, you could talk about foreign corrupt practice, but they'll pop up, you know, put some place out of business. We've actually seen companies that went out of business, but then we would find the same IP address or other things. It was the same company. They just rebranded themselves. So it's a big issue. How are we doing time-wise?
2 minutes.
Okay. Any other questions or any other thing about supply chain that I didn't address that you'd like me to try to tackle? Okay.
Thank you very much.